Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up to Colombo Chronicles Live with the Rose. I am the Rose, and I'm here for you every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m., God willing. And if they don't shut down our phones as well, and our computers and our laptops and all of our communications, we'll be just fine because we can always connect and know that there are people out there who care about you. And Colombo Chronicles is all about information, education, entertainment, and we invite very prominent people, authors and experts who know what they're talking about and can provide entertainment and or food for thought and information on what's happening in the USA and around the world, because what happens in the USA affects the rest of the world, and everyone has their eyes on the USA, especially at these challenging times we are facing in the United States of America. Who would have ever thought we'd be living through this fear-mongering and locked down as prisoners in our own home, even though we're healthy and we are a free people and we are the government, and we are watching our fellow Americans' businesses be shut down, closing their doors. It's worse than the housing crisis of 2008 when the economy was devastated and people were forced out of their homes and evicted and they lost everything. And the difference between then and now is that they still had jobs and businesses were still open. And that is a huge difference because there are forces behind all this challenge that came to America that are causing the loss of jobs and businesses, which destroys the economy. And it destroys the food chain. And it destroys farmers and farmland and ranchers, cows, chickens, pigs. And it opens the door to the billionaires who are invested in Monsanto. Monsanto is a corporation that Bill Gates has substantial stock in. They seek to control the farmers and the ranchers and their land and use non-nutritional seeds to grow crops instead of natural seeds, which have vitamins and minerals that we need for our bodies to remain healthy and our immune systems. And they intend to create lab food, lab meat, lab poultry, lab milk, lab food products for huge profit. And that sounds really yucky. If it doesn't to you, it does. So what they're doing is they're destroying everything God created, and they have set themselves up as gods. icons and gods who seek control over the land and your property and your life and your kids' lives and your education and their education, which eliminates freedom, liberty, rights. They are pro-abortion, which is a depopulation program. They are pro-transgender and pro-same-sex, which is depopulation programs. They are pro-eugenics, pro-euthanasia for anyone mentally or physically challenged, for veterans, for elderly people and seniors, because we are a problem for them on the planet here. And they seek to fearmonger people so that they are afraid to hug, kiss, hold hands, procreate in the privacy of their own homes with the intent of using AI technology to spy and track on the survivors who survive this challenge if they are able to succeed and achieve their sinister goals. So we're going to find out how this all pans out. And if the American people stand up and fight back for the constitutional freedom, liberty, rights, sovereignty, God, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of peaceful protest, freedom to gather, freedom to leave their homes, travel, work, buy, sell, operate their own businesses, go to school, go to work. It is the right to go to work. It is a human right, and it is the law of the land guaranteed by the Constitution and guaranteed by state laws that is called the necessities of life. You have the right to work to sustain your lifestyle. You have a right to work and provide for yourself and your family, shelter, food, medicine, education, travel, operate your business. You have a right in America, and the people that are denying you that right as a healthy, free people, in my opinion, it's my opinion only, you can disagree with me, as they inflate these numbers for fear-mongering, and you know which numbers I'm talking about, and silence the doctors who are telling the truth, the fact is that they are violating our human rights, not just our civil rights, constitutional rights. They are in violation of our human rights. And maybe one day the American people will unite and seek out legal advice from constitutional lawyers and educate themselves from their advice and possibly file a class action lawsuit against those who have destroyed your businesses, destroyed your livelihood, destroyed your homes, and increased depression, abuse, crime, and suicide at 200% in this country alone. So think about it. Come to your own conclusions, do your own homework and your own research. That is Rose's rant and comments for today. And now we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts in just a moment. And we have a fantastic, dynamic gentleman that is going to be with us. And he wrote a fabulous book. It's called Executive Malice. And you are going to love this book because it is right in line with some of the challenges we're facing today as far as corporations go. And let me tell you a little bit about our very special guest, and then I'll tell you a little bit more after we take a break. The Deputy Director for Human Resources, retired, a Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says, masterful plot, full of twists and turns, the setting mood, and emotions of corporate life in the 1990s were spot on. Enjoyed the strength of the two female stars who teamed up to prevail in the end. So that's pretty exciting. And let me tell you a little bit about the author. R.L. Rick Hahn, H-A-N-N, retired after 35 years of working in management positions for three major aerospace corporations in Southern California, as well as the consumer electronics industry. Over the course of a career divided equally between HR IT systems management, management development, and management training, he came to think of himself as an expert in bad management. He's currently spending his time creating material to help employees and managers survive the corporate jungle, planned for release through a new website, thegoodmanageronline.com. Rick lives in Fairhaven, Washington, where he enjoys reading, research, and writing while communing with the trees, the environment. And so now we're going to take a break, and as soon as we come back, we're going to welcome our very special guest.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping
hot
Rick. Coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is the Rose, Rose Colombo, and we're entering into the world of authors and experts. And I want to tell you a little bit more about our guest in case you missed the first part of my introductory. Rick Hahn is his name, and on his book, it's R period L period Hahn, H-A-N-N. And he is debuting his novel, Executive Malice, destined to be a big seller. The book just won Rick an Irwin Award from the Book Publicists of Southern California for the best mystery novel of the year in 2020. And so with that, let's get started, because this is an exciting book about the corporate jungle out there, and he appears to know a lot about that. So why don't we just say hello and welcome Rick to our show, Colombo Chronicles. Hi, Rick. How are you today?
Good morning, Rose. I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing great. You know, I try to think positive. You know, every day is a new day, and I'm just happy to be alive.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm happy to be able to, yes, and I'm happy to be able to speak to you about your novel, and congratulations on your Irwin Award. That's fantastic.
Well, and congratulations on yours, too. You have two, so, I mean, good company.
I know, I'm one of the rare ones.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
I was pretty honored by that. Thank you so much.
For sure, me too.
And, you know, Executive Malice, I love the name, for one thing. I want to let you know that.
Thank you.
Because I'm an advocate for justice, so I definitely was intrigued with you, the name of your book. So to get started, let's just ask you a question. Why should the audience and your readers want to even read your book or purchase your book, Executive Malice?
Well, I think there's really, I would say there are three, I really had three goals writing the book. You know, I grew up in Southern California. I actually was your neighbor right down the street at Saybrook and Edinger. So I'm a resident of Huntington Beach until like last year when I moved to Washington. I decided I would give up cars for trees. I think I made a good choice. I like the trees up here. So I really was trying to do three things with the book. You know, I had a long career, and I really never had a chance to – I've always wanted to write. And how many people say that, right? Everybody says that same thing. And I know you were able to create a book because you went through hell with all of the legal abuse, and that really motivated you. And, you know, I spent 35 years in a corporate environment seeing crazy things happen and just getting very frustrated and, like you, wanting to fight for justice. So when I retired, it was time to write my book. So really, there are three things I think people can get out of it. First of all, I just wanted to write a good conspiracy story. You know, I wanted to overcome the television crime drama constraint syndrome. You know, when you're trying to do something in 60 minutes, and I think Criminal Minds, everybody loves Criminal Minds, but the 60-minute time constraint, it really makes it difficult. Because you weave this really good story, and then at the end, the bad guy gets handcuffs on him, and there's 5 seconds of runtime. He disappears, and they go to the plane, and you're felt, you know, you feel really dissatisfied. You don't have a feeling of fulfillment. So I tried to write a story that would be balanced. It's a fairly complex conspiracy, and a lot of stuff happens, and along the way, some really good people fight against the bad guy. And there's really nice, intriguing story. So he really gets it in the end. And along the way, it goes back and forth, and they kind of outsmart each other. And it's just really kind of fun. So that was the first thing. But more importantly, or as importantly, I think, anybody who's worked in a corporate environment or had to work for a living and had bosses can relate to it. Sometimes, you know, it just drives you crazy, the things that go on, the seemingly insanity of some of the decisions that people have to deal with. So I wanted to bring that to life. So a lot of the book is based on what I went through, kind of an amalgam of my 35 years of working for crazy bosses. And I put that into the book as well. And then finally, and this was something that actually happened when I was writing the book. I didn't really start out this way, but, and I know you probably heard this too, but, the character sort of came to life, and two of my main characters sort of transformed. They ended up being different than they were at the beginning of the book, and I really felt that was important because I know you went through that too. I can tell by your background that what you did fighting for justice, it changed what you did with your life. It, you know, you started a radio show and blogging, and it just completely changed who you were and what you wanted to do. And some of that is in the story too. So you get all three things: a good conspiracy novel, a really good look into the craziness of corporate life, and a little bit about how people can change.
Boy, you hit that on the nail. I'll tell you, my life was not going in that direction. I never thought about it to even go in this direction at all whatsoever. I was in the beauty industry and had four kids with husband and dog and house and all that. You know, so I was even considering such a detour, but God had other plans for us, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And when God comes calling, we cannot turn our backs on God's mission, so here we are.
Yeah, it's really funny the way things work out sometimes.
Yes, and so, so Rick, where did you actually get the idea for Executive Malice? Because it does take place in the 90s.
It does, yes. And I left it in the 90s. It's sort of an interesting story. So just a tiny bit of background. I grew up working in Southern California in the golden age of the aerospace industry, and where I happen to live, near you in Long Beach, Orange County area, there was a huge, as you well know, a huge commercial aircraft manufacturer. And, you know, everybody I knew, my friends, my family, my parents, myself, we all started working there. I even got a summer job there when I was still in college in the early 70s. So it was sort of the place that you went, you know, 55,000 employees. It was the biggest employer in Long Beach. But I had the opportunity to go work for a smaller company, and then I came back. So that really changed my perspective. So I got into the business of, in the early 90s, I don't know if you remember this, some of your older audience members might remember, the craziness of big corporations all wanted to get better through total quality. So there was this huge movement, the total quality management improvement movement, where everybody adopted the, you know, lessons from the Japanese car industry and tried to make their operations better. Well, this commercial aircraft company was doing the same thing. So there were these huge, expensive, massive improvement programs where they were going to change the culture of the company and everybody was going to be happy and it was going to be a big fairy tale. Well, I just ended up sort of, maybe it was serendipity, maybe it was punishment, I don't know which, but I ended up having the opportunity to work with the senior executive team in this very large multi-billion dollar corporation on trying to improve the way the company was run. So I got some real insight. And the way the book came about, I was actually sitting with two colleagues, and you can imagine having worked in a corporate environment, you can imagine sitting in a windowless conference room, and we were commiserating with each other because yet there was another program that had failed, and we're trying to pick up the pieces, and it was just a mess, and our senior managers had just kind of really killed the whole program. And so one of my colleagues said, you know, this is a multi-billion dollar corporation. I cannot believe that our senior executives can be this bad just out of happenstance or circumstance. Somebody's got to be doing this on purpose. And another one of my colleagues said, wow, that would make a really interesting novel. And so that's where the whole – and I'm thinking to myself, you know, it would, because the misery that employees go through every day sometimes when management decisions seem completely ridiculous really hits home. So I actually started – I know this is weird. I started writing the novel actually in 1994 when I was still working there, and then I got a job at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and things changed. And like you, you know, kids and family and everything, life gets in the way. So when I retired, I never threw away the original pages of my first shot at the story, and I broke it back out and I finished it. So that took me about 4 years, actually. It started in 2015, and I finished it just recently. So, yeah, it was really nice to go back, pick it up, and finish it.
It is, and just for our audience, you know, to know that many books are not written by ghostwriters, they're actually written by the author, and it does sometimes take, you know, 10, 20, 25 years to write a book. My first one is from 25 years of shelved, and then it was only like 25 pages and 50 pages, and over the years things kept happening and keep adding to it. And then
right.
my second book was about redistribution of wealth and depopulation as political satire, but that didn't take hardly any time. And because I was having fun with it, because it was a fictional adventure story that led to the depopulation of the planet. And so just to say, I totally understand, you know, how it can take so many years, but a lot of people don't. And so that's why when you said, oh, I'm going to write a book, it's because they don't understand that it's not, you just don't sit down and just write a book.
Boy, that's
people,
for sure.
Anyway. And so
totally right.
Yeah, and so was your book based on real incident or purely fictional?
Well, it really is. It's a fictional story. So, and it's a work of fiction. I even have a little disclaimer, you know, like the Law and Order episodes, you know, this is any connection to things real is purely coincidental. So it is totally a work of fiction, but it's based on the essence of the challenges that employees face. You know, I honestly believe, having worked 35 years in several different companies, large and small, the vast majority of the employees I worked with were just trying to do the right thing. You know, they're trying to do the best they can with what they have to work with to earn their paycheck and to make good decisions. And it's amazing that the employees often know way better than their bosses. So it had a lot of, I took a lot of the frustrating, I'll give you just a quick example. And this was at the commercial aircraft company in the 90s. And the senior team was very frustrated because the company as a whole wasn't doing really well. So they knew they needed to improve, right? So this is a great story. So I happened to be sitting, they had a big tall executive tower. It happened to have 9 floors. And they had a big conference room at the top of the 9th floor, right? And it had beautiful windows and it overlooked the employee parking lot. So we were having this big meeting. It was late in the afternoon. It was like 4:30. And the president, this is the president of a multi-billion dollar corporation, mind you, he walks to the window and he sees the employees going out to the parking lot, right? And the employees are running to get to their cars because everybody wants to get the heck out of there, you know? They want to go to the thirsty aisle for a beer, or they just want to go home to their families, right? And so
right.
He turns around to the VP sitting around the table, and he looks at them all, and he says, "See all those employees running for their cars? How come they aren't like that in the morning when it's time to go to work? I want to see all those employees run to work in the morning, not run away from it." And he looks around to the vice presidents, and he says, "And what are you guys going to do about it?" So he abdicated his role as a leader onto the rest of the people. And so what did they do? They started this program that we had to develop, and I was really annoyed that we even had to develop it. They called it – no, this is for real, Rose. I'm not making this up, even though it sounds like a fantasy. I put it in the book. This program was called No Excuses, right? And so instead of just N-O, it was K-N-O-W, like Know Your Excuses, right? And then they capitalized the N-O in the middle. So it was little K, big N-O, little W. So it's like No Excuses. And they were really saying employees around here make too many excuses and we're tired of it. And so here's a training program for people to realize they have to work harder and do better. And that's what's wrong with our company. And I thought to myself, that is the biggest bunch of BS. And we're supposed to train this. And of course, employees just got totally frustrated, you know. So it was those kind of challenges that really motivated me over the years. And I put several of them in the book. So I had fun writing it. It felt sort of like, you know, it's time to set things right, and I'm gonna have the employees and the good managers fight back and get justice.
Well, I'm glad you're going to do that because I have a family member who actually came up with an entire great idea of putting this corporation in during these hard times. Involved with a charity and getting all this recognition, and the boss and her three employees who had been there with her for 20 years or so, all took a picture and put it in the glossy magazine, the big one in Orange County here, and left that person out. And her feelings were so hurt, and she just felt so bad. And the boss said, "Oh, well, you know, sorry about that, oh, well, because you weren't here."
Great. Oh, well.
Yeah, and so the thing is that I think that your goal to help managers recognize their employees and treat them in a good way when they do good things for their company is very important.
Thank you.
Because now I think it's very important what you're doing.
Oh, thanks. And amazingly, and I think it's still largely true, even though, you know, I spent the bulk of my career in the 90s and the early 2000s, it's still really true that if you enable employees to do a good job, that they really will try to do a good job. And I just had so many opportunities to work with employees who were just completely frustrated, where they would go to meetings and they would listen to these, you know, "Well, we want you to do this, but by the way, we're going to take away 90% of your budget because we don't have the money. So, but you're going to figure out a way to do that anyway." And somebody would say, "You know, well, if you want us to do a good job, we're not going to be able to get that done by, you know, October 31st. And they would say, "Yes, you are." And then they would just walk out, and it's like people would just look at each other going, "How are we supposed to do that?" So I really had a lot of empathy for the hardworking employees. And when I was working at the commercial aircraft manufacturer, one of the things I used to do a lot, which most of the people who worked in the office didn't really go out on the manufacturing floor and see what the people who were building the airplanes had to go through. But I made friends out there, and I like to spend a lot of time out there. So one of the things I put in the book was sort of the perspective of the people who had to actually build the products. And these were planes, right? We fly on planes every day, and these people are doing their best to keep us safe. And so you would think you would want to support them, right? So I went out there one day, and he said that I was actually talking to a director of manufacturing, and who was a good guy. And we walked out, and we looked at I'm sure you've seen them, the scissor lift things. If the airplane's really big, you have to, you know, move the employee up to work on, like, the tail engine. So they had these big, they called them mark lifts. You've seen them out where they, you know, change light bulbs on streetlights and stuff, these big machines that have a platform that move up. Well, so executive management cut the maintenance budget for these mark lifts, and they had to keep using them because they had to keep building the planes. And this guy showed me one of the ones that you'd lift it up, and then you'd be working on it, and all of a sudden it would just lose hydraulic pressure and just bounce and just drop the person, and they would be hanging on for dear life. And he's like, how am I supposed to get people to work on airplanes when they're afraid for their lives? And it's just those kind of decisions that a lot of times senior executives don't realize. The decisions they make in a vacuum affect the people who are really trying to do the work. And that's just really unfortunate. Really frustrating for people.
It is. So when you were writing Executive Malice, did any of those experiences affect you or bring up memories while you were writing Executive Malice? And which was the most satisfying ask that you found was that affected you when writing Executive Malice?
I would say and this is one of the things I put in the book in several places. And going back to, again, you know, my 35-year career, and I'm sure this is something you can relate to, there's a lot of, you know, and it still goes on because we still have the Me Too movement. So it hasn't disappeared, but there was just so much misogyny. I mean, you can go back to the 1960s. And, you know, I went to work for JPL, right? JPL is one of the premier companies in the aerospace industry anywhere. I mean, they're Caltech graduates. These people are rocket scientists. And I found out, I started there in the 90s, but I found out, do you know they had in the 1960s, they had a Miss Space Universe of the Year, and they would parade these secretaries and women around on this car, and they would have a parade and everything. And there's just that kind of misogyny, it just doesn't go away, you know? I mean, it's not like the 1970s when they had the office parties where everybody's hooking up in the back room, but it's still there. And so I think one of the most satisfying things, I have a female heroine, her name is Terry Harlan, and she's really the star of the book. And she's a very classy, competent person who happens to actually be working up here in Seattle. And then she gets moved back down, invited down to be a deputy vice president down in this company that I'm talking about. And one of the things that that really struck me was how hard competent women struggle just to be able to do their work alongside men without getting, you know, hit on and without getting talked down to. And I met one of the things that struck me when I was starting to write the book, and I actually used this in the book, I met in Huntington Beach a very, very competent woman, like you, kind of had her own business. She had a property management business, and she was really smart. And she relayed a story to me about she was having a meeting with several male executives. So she walks into the conference room, and she starts her presentation. And one of the guys raises his hand, and he says, "Look, sweetie, why don't you just go get us some coffee and let the real men figure out the technical details?" And she said, "You know, I never forgot that, and it just pissed me off." Pardon my French. It just really, really annoyed me. This is so ridiculous. And so I actually used that in my book. And a lot of the situations that Terry gets in, the guys, and again, this is set in the 1990s, but a lot of the guys have, you know, in their mind, well, she's good looking, ergo, she doesn't know anything, and we just want to hit on her, and we'll, you know. And so that kind of denigration and putting women in an awkward position by male-centric companies, it just really bugged me. And I saw it through my whole career, and it annoyed me every time. So that was one of the messages I really wanted to bring to light in the book. And that was probably the most satisfying, because she's good enough that she gets over all that stuff. And it just felt really good to do that.
Seriously, and everything you're saying is true, and it still goes on today to some degree, and
it does.
And so more. That's why more women have actually entered into the corporate world and into the jobs that men used to have in the past, because they found themselves, you know, being discriminated against and being treated like children. So they decided that they were going to, you know, make their own money and make their own way, and had nothing to do with, you know, disrespecting, you know, the jobs that men do. But also, women have a brain too, so
yeah,
know, they move
isn't that
on,
amazing?
You know.
Yeah. Sometimes they're better than the men's brains, I'll tell you.
So, what was your greatest challenge in writing your book?
The biggest challenge was, you know, I just recently retired, so I'm like in my mid-60s, and I start writing, and I think to myself, well, I've been writing all my life. I did a lot of management training, so I wrote a lot of different management programs. And I grew up as, when I was a little kid, I used to work with my grandmother who worked, she was actually editor at the Beverly Hills Citizen News. And so I was writing, you know, little stories for her. So I had a mental image of myself that this was not going to be a big deal, that I could just knock this book out. Now that I was retired, it would take me about 6 months. And, you know, and as I started writing, I realized writing a novel was a completely, totally different experience. And that was the biggest challenge for me. I really didn't know how to write a novel. I thought I could write. So I wrote and I thought it was good. And then I showed it to people and they're like, no. So the biggest eye opener for me was, you probably heard of the Greater Los Angeles Writer Society. Tony Tadaro runs it, and it's for writers mm-hmm. in the LA area. And I joined it. That was one of the best things I did, was join that organization. So I went to this workshop up in West Los Angeles, and it was called Great Beginnings. Actually, I think Irwin was at one of those meetings, so that's where I met him too, Irwin Zucker. So this was a really nice workshop where you submitted your first like two pages, right? And then they would read it, and they, you know, went through several of them. And then they had this panel of editors and novelists who would comment. And I thought, you know, I've got a really good opening here. This is going to be really good. And I got crucified. I mean, the editor just, she took, tore it apart, and I'm just sitting there thinking, I'm really glad they're not pointing at me, you know. And that was really a huge eye-opening experience for me. So I realized
it's humbling, isn't it?
It's
very humbling, because I had that happen to me when I first wrote a fictional novel, and I thought, wow, this is really good, you know.
Exactly. Then you show it to somebody, and it's like, oh.
Yeah, I sent it to this man who is an editor, and he's like, honey, this, you know, you're a good writer, but you know what you need to do? You need to write books that are truthful and tell the truth. That's you. I was like, I just wanted to cry, you know. I was like, oh, my God, I thought my book was so great, you know. But like everybody else, you do, you know, when you're first starting out, you know. So executive – oh,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no,
I was going to say,
go ahead.
One of the things I learned about writing a novel was that there's really an art to it. That when you're writing technical stuff, people have to read it. They don't have a choice. But when you're writing a novel, if you're not capturing people into the story, if you're not pulling them in, if the dialogue doesn't seem realistic, it can turn readers off in an instant. And that was the thing that I was missing. So when I first started out, you know, I was just doing narration from what they call the omniscient perspective of the narrator just telling the story. And it can turn out to be really boring. Unless you're reading a technical manual that you have to because of your job, you're not going to want to read all that stuff. So I really had to practice a lot, learning how to write dialogue that made sense. And just even, you know, every sentence really needs to capture exactly what you're trying to say to move the story along. And I know that sounds trite when you just kind of say it, but when you're trying to do it, it really becomes a whole another level. So I developed a great appreciation for anyone who's really trying to write a readable novel. And it took me, I think I ended up with like 37 drafts, something like that. So I can relate to what you were going through because it's really difficult to get a good product out of it.
And the thing is that even when you go back and read what you wrote and you thought it was great and you look back and you go, I wrote that? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. you are so right. I read some earlier drafts and I'm going, I can't believe I wrote that. That's ridiculous.
So on Executive Malice now, why don't you tell us why you think that our audience should read your book and buy your book?
Well, there's a couple things I think people can take away from it. Besides, if anybody who likes, I would say anybody who likes to read conspiracy novels, and you know, a good conspiracy novel can really suck you in when you get little bits of clues and you're trying to figure out why would somebody do this. And it's based on a character. This guy thinks that it's sort of an amalgam of all the bosses that really annoyed me over the years. But this guy just thinks that he's got all the power and he's really smart. So he just thinks he can get away with doing whatever he wants to. And basically he wants to kind of control everything and just get enough wealth and power that he can get everything he just thinks he deserves, you know? So it starts out with him and what he's trying to do with his schemes, and then the little clues. And then you get good people like my heroine, Terry Harlan, who shows up on the scene just wanting to help make the company better. And she starts to unravel this thing. And all of a sudden, a lot of the things that's going on in the company don't make sense to her. And so she starts to peel it away. So people who like a good conspiracy story, people who had spent time working in the insanity of a corporate environment, I think they will take away the sort of satisfaction of trying to do a good job and setting things right and fighting against people who really don't care and just want to do what they want. But I think also there's a couple of other underlying themes. One is that, and I use this a lot in the book too, you know, there's a power in teamwork. And I know you've mentioned this a lot. When people get together and they do things together as a unified group, there's a lot of different perspectives that can come together, and that really increases the power of what's going on. So one of the things that sort of the linchpin in the middle of the story is when several people who have, you know, the ability to see things going on and are trying to do the right thing, they start talking to each other and they start to share information and they start to compare notes and they start to work together, and they develop this sort of kind of power together as a team that really sets the bad guy back because he wasn't used to having all these people, you know, collaborating. So I think there's an underlying message of collaboration and teamwork that comes across. And actually, the few times that I felt really satisfied in my own corporate work was when I was able to work with a group of people who brought together different perspectives and really pitched in as a team and was able to create a system or a project or a deliverable that really was high quality. And I think that's really satisfying when you can do that.
Exactly. And so if it was made into a movie, who would you want to play the main role?
Who would I want to play?
Major role.
Who would I want to play? Terry Harlan? Oh, man. I don't
that's
know if
hard.
You've ever heard of it. Yeah. Have you ever heard of an actress called Andrea Roth? R-O-T-H?
No.
So if you look up Andrea Roth, there's Margaret Collins. She's another one. Saffron Burroughs. So I kind of went through a list of people that I would consider, and I, you know, watched them on TV or crime dramas or whatever. So there's several people, but I don't know if there's anybody that that would be a household name. And whoever heard of Margaret? Sarah Rafferty. A lot of people know Sarah Rafferty. Remember her from Mad Men?
Absolutely.
Carrie Harlan's actually a redhead. You know, redhead women are always great, you know. So Sarah Rafferty would be a good pick as well. So
okay.
Yeah, I don't know if it would ever get made into a movie or not, but it sure would be fun if it did.
It absolutely would be. So how can our listeners get your book, and how can they get in touch with you?
Well, that's really easy. I have Just go to thegoodmanageronline.com. It's actually all one word, thegoodmanageronline.com. So just type it as one big continuous word, and that'll take you to the landing page of my website. And then there's a little bit about the book and where you can get it. It's on Amazon. And I put links there. So it actually got released by, and I don't know if you did this with your book. There's another whole thing we could talk about, right? The wonderful saga and journey of self-publishing. That's so much fun. This was total serendipity. So when I moved up here, I'm actually near a little place called Village Books, which is probably the biggest bookstore in the Pacific Northwest, and it's right down the street from me in Bellingham here. And they're the ones who actually took on the publishing. So it's in the Village Bookstore, and they have an online presence, and I put the link online. So if you want to go to Village Books, you can get it there, but you can also go to Amazon. So either one. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's been a pleasure having you today on
Rose,
our show
really
and sharing
it.
Your novel. Oh, you're so welcome. And I hope everyone checks out the book, Executive Malice, and you can go on his website or you can go on Amazon. And on the book, it's R.L.H. like Harry, H-A-N-N. Is it Han or Han?
It's actually Han, but Han,
Han.
Either one's fine. I don't know. Either
okay.
one.
Okay, so it's R.L. Han, and again, it's A Tale of Conspiracy and Deceit, which we all love. Executive Malice is the name. Thank you so much, Rick. It was a pleasure talking to you, and much success with
Thank
your
you,
book.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. And Rick has left the building. Again, it's R.L. Han, Executive Malice. And now we're going to welcome Rob Raskin. He is a businessman, and he is also an advocate that fights against child trafficking. And he has some information he wants to share with us today. Hi, Rob. Are you there?
I am. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, I, you know, just wanted to take a little break and say hello to you and let you know that I'm very interested in what your topic is today because we are in challenging times. And you came up with a question about the dark winter that Joe Biden mentioned. So stay with me because I'm going to take a break. And I'll be right back in 1 minute.
I will be here.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe in Benson, Arizona. And if you're looking for a keepsake of the Trump victory, and I'm expecting a Trump victory, you'll want to go to onecupmore.com. That's O-N-E-C-U-P. M-O-R-E, onecupmore.com. Check out the mugs, but particularly the limited quantities of the Trump 2020 mug. And you can have it as a keepsake because this is a election they'll be talking about for generations to come. And you may use it for your personal use or as a gift, and they are gift wrapped for you. So, again, we are going to be talking to Rob Raskin, and he's going to give us some invaluable information on the dark winter. Hi, Rob. Are you ready to go?
I certainly am. You know, when I heard that the CISA agency issued a statement saying that this was the most secure election and election results in American history, I immediately said, okay, so the deep state owns the CISA, which is really not a surprise because it's associated with the CIA, and we know that the CIA belongs to the deep state and not us. So when I heard that statement about the election being the most secure, I immediately said, I better take a look at the CISA. And of course, President Trump's eyebrows immediately went up and he fired Christopher Krebs, who was the director, right away. And so anyway, I started looking at the at CISA to see what else they control. And believe it or not, one of the things under their jurisdiction is our electric grids. And so I remember this from back in 2015 when we were getting ready to prepare in case Hillary ever got in. Thank God she didn't. But we were there was a lot of talk at that time about our grids going down, and there were stories that kept creeping into our media at the time, talking about if the grids went down and there could be an EMP attack from North Korea, and there were all kinds of stories to try to throw off suspicion. But when I studied it back in the day, what I saw was that it's really incredibly simple to hack into a transformer and shut it down. And so I started looking at how many grids we have, which are three essentially, the Western, the Eastern, and Texas. And even though there are many transformers, most people don't know that the transformers come from China. And normally a transformer takes 2 years to get. One of the things that President Trump did was sign something saying no more out-of-country transformers or equipment will be used in America. But up until now, plenty of them come from China. The majority of them come from China. And there was estimates at the time in 2016, when 15 and 16, when I researched it, that it would take up to 2 years to replace a transformer. So the long and short of it is that we were concerned at the time that had Hillary got into office, she was going to want to take our guns. And everybody would say, yeah, well, how's she going to do that? And so the best case scenario for them and the worst for us would have been to shut down the grids in the wintertime. They estimated that anywhere between 2/3 and 90% of the people dead by spring from the northern half of the United States if they shut down the grids and blocked access
because
to get out of the north.
Because they would freeze to death, right?
Because they would all freeze to death, which is one reason why generators were flying off the shelves back then. So anyway,
and
the case is definitely...
Just one second. Just so people don't know who CISA is, it is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and it's part of the Department of Homeland Security. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure they understood.
Yeah. So whenever we create an agency at this point, you know, we have to assume that if the agency has any value to the enemy, that they infiltrate it and they take it over. And so that's why, you know, we're seeing that the FBI doesn't do any investigations unless they're trying to browbeat someone into recanting an affidavit. They otherwise don't do anything. And then we see that with the DOJ, virtually nobody gets arrested, indicted, or prosecuted. And then we see that the CIA essentially doesn't do anything that's in the best interest of the country. So when they created CISA and they put our election under their jurisdiction, we see how that turned out. And so they put out a 92-page report in 2018, CISA did, about our grids. So they intimately know our grids, and it would be nothing for them to shut off hack the transformers that are responsible for providing power to us, and it would be devastating to the entire country. And so they could definitely if they wanted to, mount an attack on our grids that would cripple the country.
Well, it's really interesting that for all of these years now, and with Clinton, which I've been writing about for since he got into office, opening and speaking on the radio about it, when he opened the ports to communist China, which was a nightmare because he tried to give the Long Beach Naval Base and the port to them tariff-free. And a gentleman who was a patriot that I knew, his name, he passed away recently, and he was on my cable TV show a few times. His name was Anthony J. Hilder, and he led a protest against the Clintons, and he called them Comrade Clintons, and he was really upset because he was giving it to a communist leader who had committed a huge genocide against his citizens in their country. And he had Senate hearings. And that's how the giving away the Long Beach port and the naval base to a communist tyrant leader wasn't fulfilled. And he ended up leasing it to them instead, tariff-free, for 25 years. And this CISA, also, now that you brought it up, is linked to all the web social media and to the electronic software companies like Dominion and Microsoft and Seidel and Smartmatic and many of them. So look how easily they've got us so involved with communist China, the CCA, Big Pharma, Gates, Soros, Feinstein, Clintons, Obamas, Dr. Fauci. All these people are making huge profits through China and through AI. And so this is very serious, in my opinion, because if they actually wanted to carry out their depopulation program, because even Ted Turner, who gave $1 billion to the United Nations Agenda 21, stated on a video when the interviewer asked him, do you really support 90% of the population being depopulated? He said, no, should be 95%. So these people truly do believe that the population needs to be depopulated. And that idea of shutting down the grid and freezing people to death is so sinister. I mean, allegedly, if this were to happen, is so sinister and scary because they appear to be a lot of psychopaths out there who really do believe that the planet is overpopulated. I'm glad you brought this up.
Yeah, and it's worth noting. Yeah, and it's worth noting that you're talking about the same guy who's trying to, quote unquote, save the planet from a benign virus by giving everybody a vaccine because he wants to save them. So which Bill Gates is it? Is it the Bill Gates who wants to save everybody, or is it the Bill Gates who wants to reduce the population size by 95%?
In December of 2007, Obama and Biden and Hillary and Kerry and Feinstein and the CFR and maybe other Democrats and so forth, but them in particularly, met in secret, and they approved of the Global Poverty Act, which was the Planned Parenthood being implemented worldwide, requiring the American people to pay for worldwide abortions, especially in third world countries like India and Africa and China, where there's billions of people, and for depopulation under the guise of saving lives and reducing poverty and saving the planet. So that's what you're talking about here with CISA and the grid.
Yeah, so when I saw that book, it really raised my eyebrows, because I had researched 5 years ago when we were concerned about what would happen if the Clintons came around, took office, and then they decided that they would attack us. By we were thinking at the time there was a lot of UN vehicles in the country, and we were concerned that they were actually going to shut down the grids and then go essentially neighborhood to neighborhood. And everybody said that that's not possible, we're too big, blah blah blah. But certainly it is possible if you have a plan. And I believed at that time that we were definitely in need of making sure that we had teams and we had supplies. And anyway, that's my message today, is not to panic and go run for the hills, but rather to make sure that whatever supplies you can have, to make sure that you have on hand a generator if you can, alternate radio, alternate communication sources like the handheld radio if you can, a team of people so that you're not alone. Certainly firearms and ammo. Water is very, very critical. Dried food storage is very critical. All of the things that you always hear. It's possible that nothing ever happens. It's possible that President Trump prevails. It's probable, and I believe it's going to happen. I think after he prevails, his executive order that he wrote, 13848 in 2018, that allows for the immediate confiscation or freezing of assets and arrest of any entity or person that's involved in treason, I think that that's going to give the president the ability to be able to make massive arrests on a sweeping scale. The only question, of course, is how corrupt are the agencies? Will they respond? And if they don't, does he have military intelligence or some other source or sources that would be willing to step in and follow through on the executive order to try to get a handle on all of the treason that's occurred? And then if that's the case, in retaliation, would our grids be subject to attack? And if they are, then I don't know how quickly they'd be able to get up, but I would at least want my fellow patriots to at least make sure that they don't overlook the fact that we're fighting an evil enemy with the intention of reducing the population, and that will be probably willing to do anything that they could do to accomplish their purpose and their goal. So we'd want to at least be prepared. And that's really my message for today, is that if CISA has control over those grids, we should make sure that we are prepared until such time as President Trump gets back into power, and that he gets the right people to pick up our enemies and alleviate as much of the threat as possible.
So do you think that the comment by Joe Biden that we're going to have a dark winter has to do with the grid?
Well, yeah, when he said it, of course, I didn't think of the grid, because I didn't think of CISA having control over the grids. So I looked up dark winter, right, of course, and it talks about a pandemic and probably what he meant. But after I heard about CISA having the control over the infrastructure and specifically the grids, then I wasn't so sure anymore. And then I thought to myself, he said dark winter twice in that debate, and we've heard it many times since. And I can't help but wonder if he meant the plandemic, because that's what it is, plandemic. It was planned years ago. I'm not sure if he meant the plandemic or if it was cryptic and he meant that it's going to be dark this winter because the grids are going to go down. So I sure hope that I'm wrong, but I think that it's better to sound the alarm and whisper into every patriot's ear to not overlook being prepared just in case. And I'm not sure how prepared we can be. I did build a website several years ago called CATS, C-A-T-S. It stands for Community Assistance Teams. CATS2010.com. I don't sell anything on it, so I'm not trying to make any money from it or anything like that. But I put the site up so that fellow patriots can read up on how to create a team and on the supplies that you're best off having, so that in the event that the grid was down for a period of time, you would know what supplies to have and how to put a team together to best prepare. And interestingly, there's a story on that site about a Bosnian survivalist that the electric over there was down for a year. And this is a story of a Bosnian survivalist who survived a year with the grid down. And it's an incredibly eye-opening story that's worth reading for everybody, so that they understand what would happen if the grid went down and how quickly things would deteriorate, and what your best chances are of survival directly from somebody who was in that scenario and survived. And once again, that site is CATS2010.com, CATS2010.com. It stands for Community Assistance Teams, and I built it specifically and solely to try to get information out there for fellow patriots so that they would understand how to put a team together, what supplies to have, what to expect, so that they're not totally overwhelmed, and at least they have some chance of being able to put together some means of survival in the event that we lost our grid.
Yes, I know they were talking about that all the way back through the 90s about the grid, and especially after the year 2000, it really came into play, and we were having blackouts and brownouts all over the country, and I always thought that was like their test case, you know. And I read in 2009, and I posted it many, many times, that I came across an executive order that went back from to G.H.W. Bush and to every president since then, down to Obama, that they had pre-planned a pandemic, of course they said, if it should occur, you know, a pandemic, and so it's pre-planned, and civil disruption of black-white division, because that's what they're doing. They're using BLM and Antifa by funding them to create this civil war and this racism in America to destroy the American middle class, the family, the businesses, and jobs, so they can bring America to their knees, because if you're hungry and thirsty, and then they do the blackout, good grief. And so but it also said that they would call out quarantines, which is all happening now, quarantines and curfew, put patrols on the street, and we have police officers arresting people for good Americans for what? Not wearing a stupid mask, but they let out thousands and thousands of felons and jihadists and terrorists from our prisons onto our streets. And then they said that if the president called out, if there was civil disruption and the president called out martial law at that point, they would remove the president of the United States, which they're trying to do now, and Pelosi and all these Clintons and all these people, Soros and all of them, they all want President Trump gone. They will then usher in the New World Order. So this is what they're angry about, because it was supposed to be Hillary Clinton was not angry when an unknown Barack Hussein Obama was elected and beat her out of the presidency. She wasn't angry at all. She embraced him. But she was extremely angry with Trump, who had always been a supporter and donated to the Clintons, and he donated to all the politicians, and the Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and the black community. All of a sudden now he gets to be president, and they hate him, and they attack him in every which way. This man has been totally abused and bullied and harassed and threatened, and his life threatened. And instead of, you know, instead of working with him, they're extremely angry. And so he's the thorn in their side that God is using to awaken the country to how evil this plot is. and they're trying to usher in, and it was all in writing. It didn't just happen. And these people would demean us, and they still do today, by saying we're conspiracy theorists, we're lying, it's misinformation, we're racist, and accusing us of all this their false information. And so we're going to have a very challenging time in our lives as they continue these human rights violations against us by using totalitarian mandates that order people to stay home, imprisoned in their home, with indefinite detentions, abusing us and denying us the right to work to sustain the necessities of life, which is housing, shelter, food, medicine, travel, education. And they have no real constitutional right or authority to do this. And it is crimes against humanity happening right now. So with all of this happening, I think that, you know, the country is awakened, and I believe that God is our greatest hope. Praying and God, and then being proactive, sharing information as we do, and then preparing, like you said.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. Last night we were having dinner in front of ours, and the gal sometimes uses a wheelchair when she goes into a store like Walmart. She's got trouble with her knees. And she said, it's amazing to me how many people go out of their way to be nice, to ask if they can help me get something from a high shelf or if there's anything that I can do. And I thought to myself, that's really interesting, because I think that people are inherently good, and I think that people inherently want to do the right thing. And what's happening now is almost like a snowball effect, where people are coming forward to say, I want to speak up, I want to sign an affidavit, I want to testify, I want to tell you what I saw, this is wrong. We had that Venezuelan military person who was pretty high up, who came forward the other day. And now we've got a mob boss. I don't know if you heard about this one or not. Skinny Joey Merlino is his name, out of Philadelphia.
Right.
And he's willing to come forward and testify in return for his record being expunged. He's willing to come forward and testify that the Democrats delivered him 300,000 blank ballots, and he and his crew, 98% for Biden in Philly. And so I'm sure that President Trump's aware of it, because his comment in one of his newscasts was bad things happen in Philadelphia. So I'm pretty sure that he is aware of it. But that's 300,000 ballots, and that's a mob boss who figured out how he could benefit by coming forward. And so I think that what's happening is we're starting to see the tide turn. I also heard that that parts of the military are very upset about the 9/11 attack that made them look foolish, and also the killing of Osama bin Laden when he was already dead, and there was no way he ever would have made it to Pakistan. He was on a dialysis machine, and he was immobile.
Right.
But they went ahead and said that they killed him to try to pump up Obama's, street cred and throw people off of saying, well, he's probably not a Muslim because he just ordered the death of Osama bin Laden.
And Muslims don't bury their dead in the sea. They bury them in the ground. They don't bury their dead at sea, which was a violation of their laws. So they were upset about that.
Yeah.
There you go, you know.
So,
and then you have Obama with an altered – I was the first one that put it online when I saw it, because I've been through the court system, and so I knew the truth. when he published that, posted that certificate of live birth, and I said, this is invalid because it's altered, and if you read the bottom of government documents, including that one, it says any altered document is invalid. So he's an invalid president because he produced an invalid certificate of live birth. So there you have it. So we have been played no matter what anybody says. This is my opinion, and we should speak out on our opinions, is that we are being used and abused, and our human rights are being abused by these people who hold themselves above the law, and they mandate all these totalitarian, authoritarian laws we are not paying them to do, and we paid them to uphold the Constitution and our freedom, our liberty, our rights, our sovereignty, and Americans better wake up, because this isn't what we paid them to do. So they either need to be recalled, voted out, stepped down, because that is not what we pay them to do, to lock us down as prisoners in our home while they release felons and illegals and terrorists and fund them and force us to provide for their living expenses, whether making us poor and keeping our kids in a state of confusion, because they want to go to school. They want to play with their friends. And all this bull about don't touch your loved ones, stay isolated in a bubble, they are killing more people than COVID will ever kill more people.
Yeah, and you know, a very important point, these people that are total tyrants and talk about total lockdowns, etc., those lockdowns would be a totally moot point if the police followed the Constitution and did not follow the edicts of a tyrannical governor. In New York, four sheriffs just came out and said, yeah, Cuomo said more than 10 in your house, blah, blah, blah. We will not be enforcing that. And so,
and where in the law does it even say that Cuomo has authority to do that? Where does it say CDC has the who makes money off of vaccines, and Gates and Fauci have control over any American and has authority to tell any public servant paid by the United States government, we the people, that they have these new mandates that they can impose on healthy, free Americans? Why, if we are healthy, are we being threatened with brown shirts knocking on our door and busting it down and either taking us away or plunging a weapon in our arm and assaulting us in violation of the Fourth Amendment to choose and free will that was given to us by God, not by these men and women who happen to make billions of dollars and lived off the taxpayers most of their lives in public office, refused to retire even though they're 80 years old or more, and they refused, and even though they're extremely wealthy, refused to freeze their taxpayer-funded wages while they are making Americans poor, frustrated, anxious, and causing divorce and abuse, because people are so depressed because of their lockdowns, and they're losing their businesses, their livelihood, their American dreams being destroyed. Well, these multimillionaires like Newsom, Gruesome, is having a birthday party with no mask and about 50 people, and his auntie is going to the salon with no mask and getting her hair done. Well, she mandates no one else can go get theirs done. And while you got Fauci and his wife and a friend watching some kind of sports game with no mask on, and then after the cameras are off, they rip them off. This is so insane. I cannot believe the American people have put up with this long.
Yeah, and it's very difficult because, you know, the real question, like I went with my wife, for example, to the supermarket, and did not wear a mask. I had three people ask me why I'm not wearing a mask, like I'm a danger to them, like they're going to die from COVID because I'm not wearing a mask. I said, does your mask work to protect you? He said, yeah, the one guy said. I said, okay, so then what do you care if I wear a mask? If the mask protects you and I'm not wearing a mask, so that means I'm not protected. Let me die. Well, I have the right to die. Leave me alone.
Well, coronavirus has been around in China and Saudi Arabia since at least 1999, and they're all wearing masks all these decades. So if it's working, why aren't they virus-free?
Yeah, and if the masks work, why did we let 100,000 prisoners out? Why didn't we just hand out masks?
Why do we need a vaccine then? Why do we need a vaccine if the mask works?
Exactly.
Right?
And so, if the mask works, we don't need a vaccine.
Exactly. Well, Rob, I'm so happy you called in and told us about the dark winter and to prepare and pray and hope it doesn't come to pass, and that God intervenes and that President Trump is restored his rightful place as President of the United States with God's hand on him, and that this will all be turned around and we will have America still free and with liberties and rights and sovereignty and freedom of speech and religion for our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and so that people will be able to breathe naturally through their nose and mouth like God built into their bodies and use their immune system and keep it healthy and strong so that as we've experience from this time began, these viruses come and go, and they will continue to come and go. We can't stop it. It's part of the environment and life, and it's going to happen. So every time there's a virus, the country's going to shut down, and we're going to destroy the economy and lives. This is so insane, I can't even believe it's happening, to tell you the truth.
Yep, well, they had a plan. It was called Agenda 21. It was well documented. It's on the internet. It's available. I downloaded it and read it a long time ago. I believe it's 264 pages. And then they modified it to Agenda 2030, which is what they want to accomplish in the 10 years from 2020 to 2030, and that's why we're seeing it now. So this is totally intentional on their part.
I don't understand why they are not arrested, because that's premeditated murder and premeditated genocide.
Well, it's because they control the agencies. We have to go outside the agencies, and I think that President Trump is going to be able to get that done. And if anybody can do it, he can do it. I believe that he is the right man for this time. I'm very positive and confident and optimistic about the future. I believe that we've never been more united as a people, because even though Soros pays these people to cause fires and problems and assaults, the majority of Americans of all races and all walks of life want the same thing. They want the American dream. They want more than what they have. They want safety for their children. They want good education. They want to be able to walk down the street at night. Every single one of us, black families, white families, Hispanic families, Asian families, we all want the same thing, and so we're seeing the evil and the level of evil that exists. And I think that we're going to come out on the other end of this much better. That being said, we still need to prepare just in case, and we need to have our keep our powder dry, so to speak, in case the day comes that we actually do need to defend ourselves. I hope and pray that it's not necessary, though there are going to be skirmishes after President Trump gets in, and hopefully he'll be able to bring the guard to shut them down quickly. But if they come into our neighborhoods, there's no way that we can assume that President Trump or anybody else is going to protect us as quickly as we may need. So we may very well need to protect ourselves. So we need to have supplies in case we lose our grid, and we need to have a team and a strategy to be able to protect ourselves in the event that we need it.
Thank you so much, Rob Raskin, and I'll talk to you again soon, and God bless you and your family, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Same to you, Rose. Bye now.
Bye. And that's all we have time for today. Actually, we went over our time, but that's okay, because God is watching, and God is putting his hand on America and on President Trump. He's going to intervene if we continue to put positive thoughts out there for our country, for our fellow Americans, and we continue to be proactive as far as fighting back for freedom, liberty, rights, and against evil, because this is evil that we are facing, and it's very evil, more than we ever could imagine. And so fight back against human rights violations, because you have a right to work. You have a right, according to our Constitution, according to more morality, to ethics and principles, to get a paycheck and to go to your job, operate your business, and sustain the necessities of life, just like these wealthy Democrats are doing, enjoying their birthday parties, enjoying the salons, enjoying the sports game, and laughing at us. God bless you. God bless America. And talk to you again on Wednesday, God willing, on Colombo Chronicles Live.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.